It's Storylines Midwest. I'm Keith Taylor.
And I'm Charity Nebbe. In upcoming episodes of Storylines Midwest, we'll continue our exploration of our lives through the lens of great Midwestern literature. Joyce Carol Oates will join us to talk about her novel Them and her time in the Midwest. And Jane Smiley will be with us to discuss her novel A Thousand Acres. And we'll also talk about the plight of the Midwestern family farmer.
But today we're talking about Saul Bellow's novel, The Adventures of Augie March. Augie March is many things to many different readers, but one thing it may be is one of the earliest on-the-road novels, written a few years before Jack Kerouac made that phrase famous. Sure, most of Augie's roads are Chicago streets, but here's Augie looking out at the Midwest from the door of a boxcar and seeing a fantastic landscape.
"We must be bound for Detroit. We missed Toledo," I said. "As the sun went south, it was back of us, and not on the left hand. We were going north. There was no getting off, either. I sat down, legs hanging at the open door, back broken and dry, hungry furthermore, and my eyes followed the spin of the fields newly laid out for sowing. The oak woods with hard bronze survivor leaves and a world of great size beyond, or fair clouds and then of abstraction, a tremendous Canada of light. The short afternoon soon darkened. Between the trees and stumps it turned blue. The towns became industrial, factories riding up and tank cars and reefers sitting on the spurs. Queer that I didn't worry more about being taken these hundreds of miles out of my way when there were only a few quarters and some thinner stuff in my pocket, about a buck in all."
With us now is Julian Levinson. He teaches English at the University of Michigan, and his specialty is Jewish American literature. If you'd like to join our conversation about The Adventures of Augie March, Saul Bellow, or the Jewish experience in Chicago and the Midwest, you can give us a call at 866-255-2762. That number again is 866-255-2762. Hello, Julian.
Hi there.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure.
You know, almost everyone is familiar with the book The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, and Saul Bellow called this book The Adventures of Augie March. Do you think when he did that he was trying to evoke a comparison in our minds?
I think most certainly, indeed. The two characters, the two protagonists, Huck and Augie, are really kindred spirits. But what's fascinating when we compare the two works is that really they live in different moments in American history. So for Huck Finn, who's the sort of rogue trickster figure living before the turn of the century, he can sort of he can insinuate himself into various worlds and hide there and poke fun at them and point out their hypocrisies. And the world is really malleable for him. But by the time we get to Augie March, you know, the novel takes place during the 30s, but it's really a novel of the post-war period. It was written in 1953. I think Augie's world is less porous. He can't find his way in this world. For all intents and purposes, an orphan, similar to Huck. But it's a world that is less controllable. He can't play with it with his own wisdom. His own wits fail him, I think, to a certain extent. He doesn't become the characters that Huck Finn does. So therefore, Augie is constantly repelled from his experience. And then he goes off for more experiences. Mm-hmm. Maybe this is why the novel has a hard time ending. He keeps moving. He keeps going. And he really doesn't find his place. Though at the end, he says, "I want to find my place." But it's not a porous world anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yet he seems likable, even though he's an unlikely hero. He seems likable enough. But yet I get this weird feeling from him. He never seems to really do anything on his own. I mean, it almost seems like he's more easily influenced than other heroes in a thousand ways, but much more influenced than other people.
Well, yeah, there's an interesting quality about him. He says about himself, he says, "First of all, there was something adoptional about me." And what he means by this is characters are constantly trying to impose their schemes on him and adopt him into their world. And ultimately, Augie repels these other people who are are trying to sort of coax him into their schemes. This is a world where everybody has a scheme for him. Different characters want him to follow in their footsteps, their model of how he should be. Everyone from his brother to his sort of this woman who adopts him, Grandma Lausch, sort of figuratively adopts him. And he's passive in the sense that he resists these schemes rather than making them his own.
You know, this time when I reread the book, it really hit me, like I said earlier, that it seemed like an on-the-road book, even though it's 3 years or 2 or 3 years earlier than Jack Kerouac's book that made the phrase famous. But I kind of wonder, you know, where Augie's road is going, if he has one. I mean, does Augie have an ultimate goal, do you think?
No, it's an interesting question. I've thought about this a lot, about the relationship between the two books. They're written in the 50s. The road is central to both works. They range throughout the country. In the case of Augie March, goes down to Mexico, as in On the Road as well. Mm-hmm. But I think On the Road is a superior work. Now, what I mean by this is complicated. In a sense, I think of Augie March as an enormous, fascinating, intense failure. In other words, this is a work which is trying to capture the exuberance in many ways of post-war America, but is also trying to be reflective and trying to meditate upon universal themes, while Kerouac is not so reflective. So Kerouac's project is, in a sense, simpler. He wants to go out and register this experience. And so his writing is, in a sense, more superficial. It's a writing of surfaces, which is exhilarating and works for that theme. But Bellow's work, I mean, if I could say so, is divided against itself. It wants to register the experience of America and even, as I say, of Mexico and of Paris at the end, but is also reflective and wants to go deep into the self. And these are two impulses which don't always synthesize, which don't always come together. And so I think the book has this interesting failing aspect, if I could say it like that, you know? I don't know how you feel about this. I mean, when we compare the two works.
It's an interesting question. And it's up in the air to me. I mean, the Kerouac has been so influential recently. It still seems to live. In this book, people don't seem to be quite as engaged with it these days, although when people get into it, they can certainly get absorbed in Augie. He's a winning character.
Right. Now, if you look at The Adventures of Augie March in the context of Bellow's career in general, I think light can be shed on its sort of failings as well as its fascination. The earlier works, right, Dangling Man and The Victim, right there give you a sense of what? Despair, the tormented protagonist, alienation, right?
Atlas called them Dostoevskian.
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, these figures that are on the margins of society, of the world, deeply introverted. And then with Augie March, we go in the other direction, into exuberance, into, yes, he takes blows, but he takes them optimistically, right? Mm-hmm. He doesn't cower. Maybe at the end there's a sort of a kind of a resignation that he develops, but in general he's optimistic. Now, in the later novels, the next one is Seize the Day and then Herzog. I think these two components are brought together: this sort of earlier reflectiveness and this despair and this introversion and this sort of meditative quality, brought together with the sort of exuberant style and affirmative aspect of Augie, so that you have, I think, Seize the Day, which is a much shorter novel, right? Mm-hmm. About 100 pages, I think, brings together the affirmative aspect of Augie with the real mournful and reflective quality of the earlier novels. So I think it's a crucial work on the way to the real masterworks of Bellow.
You're listening to Storylines Midwest, and the number to call if you'd like to join our conversation to talk about The Adventures of Augie March or the other works of Saul Bellow or the Jewish experience in Chicago and the Midwest, give us a call, 866-255-2762. That number is 866-255-2762. And our guest is Julian Levinson, who teaches English at the University of Michigan and specializes in Jewish American literature. We have Mary in Iowa City on the line. Hello, Mary.
Hello. I'm glad to hear your guest talking about Augie March. I wanted to ask him about Nick Adams as a bridge between Huck Finn and Augie March. In other words, Nick helped bring Huck off the raft onto land. Mm-hmm. And so since we're on land, we have Nick Adams and his adventures. And he, like Augie March, never ended. It seemed like this Hemingway got tired of Nick or got... Mm-hmm. Oh, you know, too old to relate to this character. And another thing I wanted to ask you about, you know, the British, like Jane Austen, she has Emma. Bronte mm-hmm. has Jane Eyre. And even Hardy had Tessa the D'Urbervilles. Why don't Americans have strong female novels like these?
Ooh, that's a big question, Mary. And we could do a couple of PhD dissertations about this. What do you think, Julian? I mean, we should take the first one there anyway. Looking at Hemingway as a bridge between Twain and Bellow, that never occurred to me before.
Well, I think it's fascinating. I think with the Twain, we have a novel which is very much in the colloquial speech, right, in the vernacular, mm-hmm. and then with Hemingway, stylistically, we go in the other direction. It's this sort of neutral tone, more controlled, and Bellow brings together those two aspects. I like very much what you said about Nick Adams bringing Huck off the raft and interacting with the world. I think that's right with Augie. We have a sense that he's mobile, but that he's also moving into people's homes even, and really interacting with a world that contains danger, in some cases treachery, which we have in Huck Finn. He's always in charge of the treachery, but as in Nick Adams' stories and in Bellow also, I think the treachery is larger than it can't be contained within one person. I don't know. What do you think? Because I'm talking about Nick Adams on the show, right?
Well, we did. We had a good show about Nick Adams, and it really has never occurred to me, but I think I agree with you. I mean, I think he really could, you know, be some way of engaging the Midwestern character, which might take us to Mary, the second part of Mary's question about why this whole question about the role of women in our great literatures. I mean, I think it was Leslie Fiedler back in his book in the 50s, Love and Death in the American Novel, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. who said we don't have any great women in our national literature, which didn't seem to me to take into account the Scarlet Letter. But this has been an issue. This has been a big issue.
That's it's fascinating. Certainly, Bellow would not be the place to look, right?
exactly.
Nor Kerouac, who we mentioned earlier. The women in The Adventures of Augie March, there are many of them. Some, in many ways, the character of Mimi is one of the most sympathetic in Bellow's works. But the women are often treacherous, as I said before. They're trying to entrap the male protagonist. We have this in many of Bellow's works. Mm-hmm. The question is a good one. It's a vexed one. I mean, a writer also from the 50s, Tilly Olson, another Jewish-American writer from the Midwest, from Nebraska, has incredibly strong women, but she doesn't paint on such a large canvas, right? So we don't look to her. But I think in Tell Me a Riddle, for example, we have certain model heroines. Of course, they're not self-sufficient. They work in communities of women. So maybe we have to look in a different place. We have to look for networks of women coming out of these novels, ways in which we have relating characters. Just a thought, but certainly we aren't going to find them in Bellow's work. It's very much the boisterous young man on the make, right?
Well, Julian, I want to get back to the first part of Mary's question, which it occurs to me that when she talks about Bello sort of moving on from Nick Adams in this Bridge from Huck Finn. In many ways, Bello was really rebelling against Hemingway's writing style and of his imitators, mm-hmm. wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, in a way, American fiction was at something of a standstill at this point in the mid-century, right? We have Hemingway is a sort of dominant figure, also Faulkner, but in a way more people trying to imitate Hemingway than Faulkner, right? There's something very deceptively simple about Hemingway's style. You know, every year they have the Bad Hemingway contest, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's a sense that one can imitate Hemingway, but of course it never comes out quite Hemingwayan. So what we have then is a kind of a stultifying influence. That is Hemingway's writing style, people trying to write in that neutral fashion. And then Bello comes along, and he's much more of a product of his European reading, of his reading in the Russians and in Flaubert, and different influences come into his work. And as I say, we have this complexity, this range, a refusal to write in the terse Hemingway mode. And I think that part of the reason people celebrated The Adventures of Augie Marsh so much when it came out, it's precisely because it was a burst of fresh air. It was it had a depth that it was no longer contained and controlled in the way that Hemingway's works are, right? And so emotion could come through in a more honest way. It was no longer controlled, ironic, distanced, and cold. It was warm, exuberant, and really champions feeling, direct expressions of emotion, you know? Mm-hmm. When Augie is with Mimi, it's her abortion, and he stays by her, you know, and his brother thinks it's just because he wants to seduce her or something, but really there's an emphasis on Augie's generosity and his ability, his empathy at that mm-hmm. moment, which is, you won't find that in Hemingway, you know.
Yeah. So, you're listening to Storylines Midwest. The number to call if you want to join our conversation is 866-255-2762. Right now we have John in Ironwood, Michigan on the line. Thanks for joining us, John.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing well.
This is great. I love it.
Great.
I'm a former, I guess you'd call me a former Chicago native.
Great.
Born into the newspaper
yeah.
business.
Uh-huh.
Chicago born.
Yeah, outside Chicago, actually. But being on the newspaper, if anything else, I just, you know, I was listening to the program, and it struck me that I wonder if Mr. Bellows had contact with some of the local Chicago writers, people like Studs Terkel,
mm-hmm.
Art Buchwald, Mike Royko, and Irv Kupcinet.
Well, I certainly know that Bello has over the years been involved with Studs Terkel talking about one thing or other.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and I know that he's so involved in the Chicago community, even now that he lives in Vermont, I think. He still keeps very close tabs on Chicago, and all those newspaper men, I suspect that he knew pretty well. Don't you get that sense, Julian, that Saul Bello just loved his city and wanted to be a part of it?
Yeah, definitely. Even as he really increasingly puts New York at the center of his fiction, but there is a tenderness towards Chicago. And in this recent book, Ravelstein, he returns to Chicago after many, many years. So I think he has a deep tenderness for Chicago. And
well, let's talk about that a little more, Julian, because I mean, when we think about the American Jewish experience, because of so many books and because of popular culture, we think of New York. You know, we think of the Lower East Side in particular. But Bellows, you know, is coming at least from a different experience. I mean, when Irving Cutler earlier described that Wicker Park neighborhood, that didn't sound like the Lower East Side at all. You know, that was a very different kind of thing. Do you think there's something essentially different about the Jewish community in Chicago when you compare it to New York, or is it the same thing?
Chicago doesn't have the same position in the collective memory of Jewish Americans that the Lower East Side does. Or Newark, for that matter, which, you know, through Roth, we have the sense of Newark's Jewish community, really deep immigrant community. And really, that's the key to the story, isn't it? The immigrant community was less dense in Chicago. There's actually a passage in the, towards the beginning of Augie March where he's talking about sort of walking through the neighborhood amongst these Poles. And he says, we were just a handful of Jews among them in the neighborhood. And sometimes we were chased, stoned, bitten, and beat up for Christ killers, all of us, even Georgie, his brother. But I never had any special grief from it or brooded, being by and large too larky and boisterous to take it to heart. I think that we wouldn't find that in a Jewish American novel written by a New Yorker in New York. Something, for example, in Malamud. All right, or Roth writing about Newark. The Jewish community is denser in these places and really produces a sense of an intermediate space, right, between Europe and America, a stable place. That is to say, the Lower East Side sort of exists in its sort of vital state from the 1880s through the 1930s, really. So that's a significant period. We have a development. We have newspapers. We have all kinds of the Landsmannschaften, which are the societies dedicated to different places in the old country. We don't have any of this vitality in Chicago. We don't have the labor union movements, right? We don't have the sort of intense socialism that we have in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And the sense that, as I was reading an interview with Grace Paley, she said, to be Jewish for me growing up was to be socialist, right? This was her sense of coming out of that experience. This kind of secular, socialistic Jewish community was much more transient in Chicago, not as dense, right? I think it marked the writers and the literature in a very different way. So that's, of course, Bello participates in the creation of this collective memory of the Lower East Side of Manhattan because he comes to New York and writes these beautiful New York Jewish novels. It's almost like he becomes more Jewish when he comes and stages his writings in New York, you know. Seize the Day, I'm thinking of, or of course Herzog, right? Which maybe couldn't have been written about a new a Chicago Jew.
Well, we still have a few minutes in the show to take a few more calls. So if you had some experience in the Chicago Jewish community and want to weigh in on this subject, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-255-2762. That number again is 866-255-2762. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the influence that Bello has had on other authors, maybe other Midwestern authors. Who are some of the people that were most influenced by his work, Julian?
Well, I think one place to look would be the other Jewish American writers. So not necessarily the other Midwestern writers, but a whole generation of Jewish American writers who came just a little bit after Bello. There's actually an interesting sort of fact of in Jewish American literary history. Philip Roth and Norman Podhoretz are two sort of literary intellectuals coming up in the 40s, really. And they both read Augie March, right? Sort of young writers cutting their teeth on the European masters, but also looking for an indigenous American Jewish voice. And they both read Augie March, right, in the early 50s, Podhoretz and Roth. Now, Roth found this to be the liberating experience. He found in Augie March the license to go on and become Philip Roth, right? He goes on and writes these exuberant first-person narratives himself. And I think Roth's recent works, the so-called American Trilogy that's just come out over the past couple of years, American Pastoral, The Human Stain, and I Married a Communist, amazing works that I think are really clearly the impetus behind those works. Even 40 years later, I think you could say you could see Augie March there, mm-hmm. the willingness to range through America. But on the other hand, we have Podhoretz reading these works. And Podhoretz is sort of an aspiring poet at this time, also writing literary criticism. And Podhoretz did not believe in the exuberance of Augie March. That is to say, whereas for Roth this was an authentic expression of passion and exuberance, for Podhoretz he thought it was forced. He somehow didn't believe it. And he was skeptical. He thought that it's what we would call bad faith in the novel, that he was saying he was exuberant and he was sort of describing all these experiences, but Podhoretz thought that it was somehow dishonest, that the core emotion was missing. And and Podhoretz, of course, went on afterwards to become a literary critic, specializing in short essays, but never, he wrote interesting autobiographical works as well, but really never became a writer with a large canvas in the way that Roth did. And so what I deduce from this, this very small sampling, of course, just Podhoretz and Roth, is if you're a Jewish American writer coming up in the 40s, and you love Augie March, then you will sort of go on to produce things because it will be a useful influence. But if you're skeptical of it, then you go on and you don't take the promise, and then you don't have that influence there, and then you sort of become a critic or something. I don't know. It's a little theory I've been working on thinking about literary influence. What's that?
I think it could fly.
It could fly.
I like it.
In other words, you have to believe in your influence. You can't look too closely at at what's underneath this exuberance. If it's there, if it powers your writing, take it, as they say, take it and run with it. Right? It's Augie March is passionate and exuberant, and skepticism about it will only reflect badly on yourself.
Well, Julian, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Julian Levinson teaches English at the University of Michigan, and he specializes in Jewish American literature. For more information on Storylines Midwest or the books we're reading, you can visit our website. It's storylines.ala.org, or you can check out your local public library. Participating libraries have copies of the books, they have program schedules, and they also have discussion guides.
Storylines Midwest is produced by Tamar Charney. Our engineer is Bob Skahn.
We had production help from Rebecca Williams, Amanda McWhorter, and Allison Zatorsky.
Today's readings were performed by Daniel Pinkwater.
Our library discussion guides were written by David Long. Georgia Lomax coordinates the participating libraries.
The executive producer of the Storylines America Project is Paul Zalis.
Storylines Midwest comes to you from the studios of Michigan Radio at the University of Michigan. I'm Charity Nebbe.
And I'm Keith Taylor. Thanks for being with us.
Storylines Midwest is a project of the American Library Association, funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities and Barnes & Noble Booksellers.
Carl Sandburg called his Chicago the City of Big Shoulders.
A generation later, Gwendolyn Brooks wondered if a dream could sing an aria in a ghetto building on the South Side.
Carl Sandburg, Gwendolyn Brooks, and the poetry they found in Chicago on the next Storylines Midwest.